You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for March 21st, 2014. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the grasp of the GOP outreach headquarters, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
So GOP outreach, they're finally getting it.
Yay!
Vince Priebus is on this.
He's swinging his cod around. His little Priebus cod, little Rince is out.
Little Rince is swung around.
Yeah.
They're doing these ad series about, you know, it's the American dream.
And I'm a conservative. We believe in the American dream,
so that's why I'm a Republican. And they find all these actors, you know, who are not, they're totally not gay, though. There's no gays on there.
Not gay.
And nobody's at an abortion clinic talking about freedom.
And if you think you've seen him in a Swiffer commercial, you're wrong.
No, you haven't. Although I saw a Honey Made graham cracker commercial this week on YouTube, just opening up a YouTube I was looking at, that was so over the top in terms of inclusiveness.
Yeah.
It made you get it. They had the gay couple. They had the interracial couple. They had the handicapped couple. They had the everything except the little people couple. Enjoying graham crackers and talking about, and this is wholesome. Okay.
Did they have the wise old white man to come on and round it all out? Fred Thompson.
No, they didn't have Fred Thompson come on and talk about reverse mortgages after that. No.
Because there is a war on Christians in this country, honey.
Well, the head of a conservative political action committee in Texas.
Yeah.
Whose name is Carrie Christman. I'm not making that up.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. I'm not making up that name.
Blood-soaked cross-bearer.
She was in an interview with Texas's Capital Tonight television show. And she said, look, we need real-world solutions, not equal pay laws.
Yeah. That's great. That sums it up really well.
That's your outreach. And she said, look, we don't need more rhetoric. Women are extremely busy. We lead busy lives, whether working professionally or working from home. And times are extremely busy. It's just a busy cycle for women. We've got a lot to juggle. And when we look at this issue, we say, what's practical? We want more access to jobs. We want to be able to go and get a higher education degree at the same time that we're working or raising a family. Yeah, everybody wants to do that.
Yeah. That's,
We're not busy enough. We want to be busy.
You might be confusing this portion with the science fiction university portion.
Yeah, this is not science fiction university. She says, we want to, believe me, I have done this. I have raised, I have had two in diapers and gone to night school.
Yeah.
At the same time. And it's sleep in your clothes at night. You just fall into bed.
Yeah. That's common sense.
That's common sense. And it's a practical way to approach the problem. And so someone had the audacity to suggest in this Salon post that maybe the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act would help her out.
Uh-huh.
No, that's not practical.
That's not practical. Well, you know, you get the feeling this happens every 3 days, actually, but it happens every election cycle, is the poll-tested words go out.
Yeah.
And practical is
practical.
Busy and practical.
Busy and practical. That's what women are. Absolutely.
And you can just see Frank Luntz asking a room full of women at, a la Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
So what words do you think describe your life? Well, we're very busy. And, you know, we're only interested in practical solutions, you know.
Right.
And that is correct. They're going after the lady vote. And ladies, as you know, are very busy and practical. They want real world solutions, not these crazy notions like healthcare for people or people should be paid a living wage. That's just crazy nonsense talk from crazy land.
And then Gawker has pointed out that there's a new series of ads starring Scott Greenberg, a 30-year-old ad guy with a cool shirt. He's a hipster. He's young. He's concerned about paying for things. And that's why Scott is a Republican. And they are running ads starring this 30-year-old ad guy with a weird haircut and cool shirt.
In
14 swing Senate states this election cycle. And he literally says in his ad, I shouldn't have to check my bank account before I fill up my car. So much of my paycheck ends up going to gas. So when it comes to energy policy for this country, I'm for everything. Solar, wind, shale gas, oil, whatever. I'm a Republican because I believe we should have an all-of-the-above energy policy.
Uh-huh.
Somebody pointed out, after they saw this ad, that Scott drives an Audi.
Yeah. Nice Audi, Scott.
Nice Audi and leather jacket from, you know, American Apparel, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And Gawker pointed out, too, that if he really likes all of the above energy policies, he should vote for Obama.
Yeah. Which
is kind of sad in a way. We're not terribly happy about that. But if you want drill baby drill plus nuclear plus shale oil plus all of the above, Obama's your guy.
Yeah.
So
sadly, yeah. that is.
We're not happy about that over here. But
and we have practical real world solutions.
And outreach.
That will never go anywhere. I mean, believe me, everybody I know, you know, all the progressives I know or think of or can imagine have a whole shelf, board feet of ideas that they would love to see implemented. They're never going to go anywhere.
Oh, and 50% of them are written by Robert Reich. I mean, he's written how many books on, you know, what the liberal revolution should look like? Yeah.
And sadly, it all gets down to counting votes.
Yep.
It always gets down to money and votes. It always gets down to that. And if you would like it to work differently, I'm in your camp. But it doesn't work differently. That's over in the better universe.
Mm-hmm.
Over in the better universe, David Gregory is trying to upsell apple pies with your lunch. Over in the better universe, David Brooks is writing obits for a small town magazine somewhere in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
They all have honorable jobs because over in the better universe, they're paid a living wage. But people like that would never be anywhere near a microphone or a pen or public opinions, but they are.
Mm-hmm.
So however many good ideas you have and however fervently you wish them implemented, until you build a governing coalition that can draft legislation, pass legislation, get it signed by a president, get it upheld by the courts, and make it non-overturnable.
Yes, right.
That's the world you live in. So I appreciate all of the wonderful mental exercises about all of the cool things we could have. You know, that if we could have a ham sandwich if we had bread and ham and, you know, other stuff.
But Swiss cheese and mustard.
Yeah, but we don't have any of those things. So, but we could have a ham sandwich. It's theoretically possible. Yes, we could have many things. But right now we live in this practical real world universe where Republican hipsters are going to the polls.
No, they're not. No. There is no such thing.
There's one. There's one,
and he drives an Audi, and he gets paid to be in these advertisements.
Sure. I mean, and somebody had to step in when Andrew Sullivan decided to become a libertarian.
See?
So, you know. So.
All right, let's play Guess Who Said This.
Yes, let's guess. Let's
can
play it.
Can I read the quotes?
Sure. You read the quotes.
And then you tell me who said them.
I will.
Can I read both of the quotes?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, this is our solution to the situation with Russia and Putin, okay?
What should we do? Should we do?
Well, obviously, it's beyond our control. The Russians are advancing. There is nothing that will stop them, and we are not going to go to war over it. What is to be done? Let's be real. There's nothing to be done militarily. All we can do is alter Putin's cost-benefit calculations.
All right, okay. the first
now,
quote.
I think...
Uh-huh.
Second quote sounds a lot like what John Kerry said.
It does sound that way.
What we can do is alter Putin's cost-benefit calculations. I'm going to say John Kerry.
Yeah, for both of them?
Yeah, John Kerry.
Okay.
I'm going to say that the first one, we are not going to go to war over it, is Clarence Page.
Yeah.
Washington Post.
Yeah, a liberal columnist.
Yeah.
Who's a pragmatist? Who is a pragmatist who lives in the real world?
Well, he knows we're not going to go to war over Crimea because we're not. Yeah. Okay. So those are my guesses. Number one is Clarence Page, and number two is John Kerry.
Yeah. You're wrong on both counts.
Really?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. The first one is Charles Crabhammer. famous.
Crabhammer. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The mortal remains of Charles Crabhammer, who again for some reason has columns everywhere and appears at will on television, who was speaking about the invasion of Georgia in 2000.
Oh.
But the second one is Charles Crabhammer. also in 2008.
That's a trick question.
It is a trick question. Also talking about the Russian invasion of Georgia.
So he said, let's be real. There's nothing to be done militarily.
Yeah, there's nothing to be done about it. There's nothing you can stop them.
And how many decades ago did he say that?
That was way back in the Bush administration. Oh. Or, as it's known in the Republican circles, before time began. The land before time. No one knows what happened before 2009. It's a great big mystery. Back way back there, there's a sort of a glittering light where imaginary Reagan is standing. Very benign, shining his tear that wall down light on everybody. But before January 2009, no one's really sure what happened or who believed what or what sort of votes were taken by anybody. There's no record of any of it. So we just shrug our shoulders and go, well, we'll just go forward. Don't look back. Go forward. So, yes, the Republicans were very much lined up. The conservatives, the real conservatives, the real true conservatives like Charles Krabhammer were lined up hard behind. Are you kidding us? There's nothing we can do. It's a faraway country. It's right on Russia's border. You know, screw it. It's bad, but there's not really much we can do about it. Nobody talked about Bush's weakness. Nobody talked about inviting aggression. Nobody talked about, like, Bill Kristol. Mm-hmm. Talked about how war weariness is no goddamn excuse for not putting other people's children in the front of bullets. Not his, of course, because he's a coward and a traitor. But as are all neoconservatives, frankly, who still exist on the face of this earth. But again, all that stuff was said before 2009, and so it doesn't count. Mm-hmm. And no one remembers who really said what because no records were kept. So very sad.
That's very sad.
Yes, it is.
All right. We have another quote that I thought was really over the top this week.
Yes.
From it's a both sides do it-ism.
Yes, it is.
I'm kind of shocked at the source of this. Not really. Dylan Byers at Politico. Do you want to read this? This is
sure.
This really blew my mind.
At Republico, as it's known in polite circles
around the world. Yes.
This is because it is not sufficient to beat the dead horse. It is important that you completely drive it into a state of zombiehood where it rises again and attempts to kill you. So as we do every week and have done for the last 500 years, we try to bring you yet another example of where some prominent person in a prominent media
who gets paid to write this,
paid to write this shit, comes up with some bizarre Rube Goldberg explanation for why both sides are always wrong about everything. And again, once you start looking for it, you see it everywhere. It is everywhere. It is the single most destructive lie in politics. And a whole bunch of people have built a whole lot of careers at the very top of our media maintaining this lie. And I will maintain to my dying day, the minute you crack that, everything else becomes easier. But mm-hmm. until you break people like Dylan Byer, until you put them on in the public square and flog them, until you drive them out of polite society and back into whatever sewer they crawled out of, we're never going to be shut of the Republicans or their filthy agenda, because you can't argue anything is worse than anything else when someone like Dylan Byers rolls up in his both-sider truck and says, no,
and
no,
says
no.
This, says this, read it.
But the real problem with the debate over data journalism is that both sides have needlessly turned it into a competition when it isn't one. Pundits like David Brooks and Joe Scarborough laughed in Nate Silver's face when he claimed that math alone could anticipate the outcome of a presidential election. Silver, in turn, lobbed grenades at the opinion classes en masse, calling most of them worthless. And yet, we've seen that both qualitative punditry and quantitative measurement can be, by turns, useful and useless. There are good elements, there are good columnists and bad ones, just as there are good quants and bad quants. The columnist might be making more noise, but that doesn't preclude them from finding the signal. Furthermore, the idea that talking heads are, quote, worthless, overlooks how many people just enjoy listening to someone else talk. Now, the thing that he does... that he never gets to in this point is that Joe Scarborough and David Brooks were wrong.
Were wrong.
Provably and Silver was right. Wrong. Silver was right. They were wrong. It's that simple. But it can't be that simple. Because if Joe Scarborough is wrong and David Brooks is wrong, then maybe I'm wrong. And the whole charade falls apart. So, again, Dylan Byers will continue having a job at Politico as long as he wants it. Until presumably a job opens up on Meet the Press or ABC News or some other outlet. This is just a swirling, incestuous cesspit of circle-jerking idiots who are all in on the scam. And that's why real liberals are not allowed on television.
Well, and I got to say, this statement that he makes that talking heads aren't worthless because people enjoy listening to someone else talk.
Yeah.
That explains Elizabeth Hasselbeck.
Oh, yeah.
On Fox and Friends. Perfectly.
Quack, 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 quack.
It doesn't matter if she's right or wrong or does it says anything that makes any sense.
Well, I've always said that Laura Ingraham's voice is so soothing. That's her real... That Ann Coulter's voice is such a gentle, mellifluous sound, a pure natural tone, that that's why she exists, as opposed to the horribly Harridan-ish evil things she says. But you can't have a public debate. You cannot have public discourse as long as Dylan Byer is a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea... Brother Charles Pierce wrote a really nice column this week about Bill Kristol.
Mm-hmm.
If I may just step into that for 1 second. Do you mind?
No, go right ahead.
Charlie Pierce wrote a wonderful column about Bill Kristol, the awful, odious melanoma that walks like a man, Bill Kristol, and was on fire, and it was a true Jeremiad, as I called it. It was a true attack, a despairing fire and brimstone, you bloody butcher, why don't you just shut the fuck up and go away? How wrong do you need to be? How many other people's kids do you need to kill to, you know, prove your manhood? And I read it and was fine. I went to the comment section and people were referring to it as the greatest neocon takedown they'd ever read. And it was a very good one. And they referred to it as a takedown. And that word just stuck in my head because it's not a takedown. Because Bill Kristol will never be taken down.
Mm-hmm.
Taking down means taking someone to the mat or humbling them. And no one is going to humble Bill Kristol. No. And no one is going to take him down. Because, and I wrote this with great deference to Mr. Pierce's writing skills. I said, the reason I say this is because it reminds me very favorably of all of the takedowns that were written of Bill Kristol in 2003, mm-hmm. and in 2004, and in 2005, and in 2007, and in 2009, and in 2011. Oh, and by the way, this was the year that Paul Wolfowitz got a job at the World Bank for being horribly wrong. This is the year that David Brooks, who used to work for Bill Kristol, got a job at the New York Times. This is the year Bill Kristol was given a job at Time Magazine. This is the year he lost that job, but then they gave him another job at the New York Times. And on and on and on. And by the way, Bill Kristol, who lost his job at Fox, now has a job at ABC News. So Bill Kristol, as a person, is like Batman. He's indestructible. You cannot dislodge him from the media ecosphere. And yet, as a person, as an entity, as a spouter of ideas, he is so grotesquely awful and evil and wrong that one must of necessity conclude that there is a conspiracy to keep him employed.
Yeah,
someone somewhere is making calls saying, you're going to hire this son of a bitch and you're going to put him on the air. I want to know who that guy is.
Well, and the fact that Bill Kristol has never, ever, ever had to worry about long-term unemployment.
No.
I don't think he's ever been between jobs for more than 3 months.
Never. And I don't take anything away from Charlie, but we liberals have been writing the same, oh my fucking God, can you believe what Bill Kristol said
for 10 years. Yeah, 10 years.
And he's been wronger longer than there have been blogs. He goes all the way back to the 90s. He used to work at ABC News and was fired in 1999. So he never goes away. And which begs the question, who are the people who keep propping him up? What are their names?
Mm-hmm.
Where do they live? What's their phone number? How do you get to those people? How do you stick a camera in their face? And the answer is, I don't know. But you know who would know? Charlie Pierce probably knows some of those people.
Mm-hmm.
He probably travels in that circle. I'm not saying he has any secret insight into the upper workings at ABC News, but I'm sure he knows people in his professional universe. I'm sure people know in their second or third hand. I'm sure people know at MSNBC. I'm sure people know at NBC, who keep booking people like Bill Kristol onto the air. Someone knows why Bill Kristol still has a job, and it is no longer sufficient to just go on the air and say, isn't it a shame this bloody-minded monster keeps getting a job? Yeah, it is. But someone keeps giving him a job. And the person at ABC News is a 12-year-old executive producer who a few years ago was editing his college newspaper, and now he swings enough dick at ABC to hire arguably the most evil, awful, wrong, despicable traitor in American media and call it a good hire. And nobody questions him.
Well, and I hate to go all both sider on you.
Yes.
Glass, but we kind of have a similar person on our side in the person of Mark Penn.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And, he screwed up Hillary's campaign so badly.
Absolutely.
That no one, I mean, there's an article this week in Mother Jones of Hillary insiders saying they will not support Hillary if Mark Penn is brought onto the campaign.
Uh-huh.
And here is, you know, the guy responsible in Bill Kristol for deciding that Sarah Palin would make a good running mate for John McCain.
Yep.
And he's in the public eye commenting on politics all day long. Mark Penn had to go find a job at Microsoft and is he on TV anymore?
No.
I guess he is.
No. I haven't seen him, but I don't watch those shows. No, I believe me, having recently decamped from Chicago after 25 years, mm-hmm. I get clout. And I get nepotism and inbred. Bill Kristol's Irvin Kristol's son, the grandfather of neoconservatism. He is of the manner born. But in Mark Penn's case, it's really simple to understand. Bill Clinton wants him on the job. Bill and Hillary Clinton would like you to hire him. These are decisions you can trace to a person or a group of people. Mm-hmm. I cannot trace who it is that keeps putting Bill Kristol at Time Magazine and the New York Times and on MSNBC NBC.
When he's been physically incompetent, I mean, in terms of what I mean physically incompetent, I mean, actually the basic requirements of his job description to write an article that is factually checkable.
Yeah.
He's not able to do that.
No, he's
incompetent. He's been fired from jobs for simply getting the story completely wrong.
Yeah.
And not fact-checking anything.
2006, you might remember, was the year that Stephen Colbert just shredded him.
Yeah, yeah.
Just destroyed him on the air. And Bill Kristol, you know, got red-faced and mm-hmm. stuttered and stammered and smirked off and walked away. And there was this great, oh, my God, finally, someone's built a fucking bonfire into the son of a bitch and roasted him alive in public. And it didn't affect him at all. And the only way that can happen is if you are the owner of the company. If you're the boss,
yeah,
or if you have, as was described in The Usual Suspects, if you are protected from on high by the Prince of Darkness,
yeah,
Bill Kristol and people like Bill Kristol are obviously protected and shielded and hired and promoted by a small group of people who operate at the very highest portions of our media.
You're listening to the Professional Left Podcast, professionalleft.blogspot.com. The business of ignorance.
Yeah.
Is directly related to this.
It really is.
You wrote down on our podcast notes about Robert Proctor. You want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. We touched on him either last podcast or the one before that. Mm-hmm. A mention was made of this study on the Chris Hayes show. But he's a professor of history at Stanford and is one of the world's leaders in the study of agnotology.
Hmm.
Which is the study of culturally produced ignorance. Hmm. And his entire field of study is when you have whole industries devoting themselves to creating public misinformation and doubt about mm-hmm. their products and activities.
Mm-hmm.
The tobacco industry,
yep.
Big oil, big pharma, big you name it. But there is an actual study, a field of study that studies how people are lied to and why they continue to crawl back to their same people who've lied to them over and over again
mm-hmm.
and beg for more, how they dig their heels in and refuse to believe that they've been duped, because who wants to live with that on your resume?
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much evidence you pile up in front of them, they just won't believe it. And there is an entire science, an entire industry pioneered again by the tobacco industry, that the whole concept was just keep lying
mm-hmm.
and keep sowing doubt and keep saying there's another side to this story and keep saying, well, you know, maybe that's not true. Well, we have scientists too. Keep the people who are already part of the scam, who you've already duped, keep giving them reasons not to believe information coming in from the outside. And this is where I do think are the two halves of our political culture are just wrong, are just asymmetrical. They're just not the same. I heard someone on MSNBC talking about how, you know, both sides have their bunkers and both sides have their echo chambers and blah, 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 blah. Sorry, that's just not true.
Mm-hmm.
One side has a bias. One side lies. And you know what? If you give me new information, I will change my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't give me new information from the Wall Street Journal every time. You can't keep emailing me fucking articles from Fox News and Peggy Noonan.
And Drudge.
You can't... I'm not going to accept those sources of information, because every time I have dug into them, I have found, after 45 seconds of search and a couple of stops by Snopes, that they're lying.
Yeah.
So at some point, you as the disseminator of that information have to take responsibility for the fact that you are a disease vector.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the fact that liberals don't listen to Paul Ryan, yeah, we do. I've listened to enough of Paul Ryan over the years to know he is a pathological liar.
And a racist dog whistler. Yeah.
And he doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about.
Yeah.
And so I don't.
He's philosophically motivated and has no actual facts behind him.
Yeah.
And it's so it when and the biggest lie he tells is that he's a numbers guy. He's not a numbers guy.
And he cares about deficits. He never gave a shit about deficits under George Bush. Never. So the question is, having established your credentials as a world-class repeat recidivist lying offender, why would I want to listen to you again about anything?
Yeah.
Your entire shtick is being a liar. So I'm not going to listen to you. That doesn't mean I'm not interested in new information. I'm not interested in new information from you because you're a liar. So
we're at 58 minutes.
Right? Yeah, I know.
I want to talk just for a minute about our congressman.
Yes.
Rodney Davis.
Yes.
Who sent a newsletter. And I know we talked about Shimkus's newsletter.
Yeah.
You know, and his ability to defend polluters. But Rodney Davis is in a swing district.
Yeah.
He's in a real 50-50 Democrat-Republican district and has to play nice. We've talked about him before. He has to play nice. Now, he's voted to repeal Obamacare, and he's voted with his party on a lot of stupid stuff. And I'm not enamored of him. However, his newsletter was quite a study in contrast to Shimkus, who is in a safe district. Shimkus can go blah, blah, blah. Coal ash is not a hazardous waste. And
it has nutritional value.
It has nutritional value. He
sure
can do those kind of things in his newsletter. Rodney Davis's newsletter last week talked about reasonable bipartisan fixes to Obamacare.
That he sponsored. That was headlines across the country, wasn't it?
Blue? No, it wasn't.
Oh, that's right. It never was mentioned anywhere.
Anywhere. Except here. You're hearing it here at the Professional Left Podcast because I read his newsletter.
Yeah. Wow. Journalism, Blue Gal.
Rodney Davis sponsored a bill which was just a little fix to Obamacare in terms of hiring veterans.
Yeah.
If you hire a vet and he's covered by VA insurance, that does not count against you as you are hiring somebody that you have not given health insurance to.
Uh-huh.
Now, you would think that would be logically already in the bill, but apparently it wasn't. And so House of Representatives 3474, the Hire More Heroes Act, was something that Rodney Davis wrote the bill. He authored the bill. It incentivizes small businesses to hire veterans by exempting veterans who already receive health insurance under Veterans Affairs. And they are now counted towards the number of employees required by the employer mandate. So you won't be punished for hiring a vet. That's the point. Then he also...
which is fine.
He did a couple of other little bills. He did one if you have specific religious reasons why you would not want to buy certain coverage, that you're exempt from buying that coverage. And that a little tiny bill. The third one was that volunteer firefighters did not have to be included on the employer mandate.
Because they're volunteers.
And that passed because they're volunteers, right?
Right.
And so they are exempt. Volunteers and emergency responders who are volunteers are exempt from the employer mandate. You do not have to cover them because they are volunteering to work for you.
Yeah.
That legislation was approved by the Republican House of Representatives unanimously, 410-0.
Yes.
The bill about Hire More Heroes Act passed 406-1. And this is what Obama has been talking about, which is if there's something wrong with the bill, let's fix it.
Right. But we can't say that too loud.
We can't say that too loud because repeal and replace Obamacare is what they're running on next fall.
And it's death panels and it's various attempts to socialize and make your kids gay.
And you usurper.
And so the idea that we are going to accommodate this tyrant by accepting that this thing is going to exist from now on and that we just sort of have to deal with it and fix it is anathema. So Rodney Davis, who I'm not going to vote for.
No, I'm not going to vote for either.
But actually proposed what sounds to me, as a layman, to be some reasonable fixes. If you're a veteran...
Well, and they passed unanimously.
I know.
I mean, it's not a big deal. These are little fixes that I can't imagine Obama's not going to sign if they ever make it through the Senate.
If you're a veteran...
But you're a veteran and you're like hired, your VA insurance...
You get to
then you can still get hired by somebody and they're not going to say, well, yeah, but I got to hire people that I can cover under Obamacare. No, of course not.
Right.
Nobody's going to say no to that.
And that's exactly the kind of sort of hand stitching that all legislation, especially legislation that tries to do very big things, attempts to do. Again, this is why we never visited the moon. Because the first three or four rocket ships blew up. Therefore, we just gave up because, you know, it's impossible.
This is why Democrats worked once the Medicare drug plan went through under Bush to provide fixes to it.
Yeah.
Even though they were against the unfunded mandate for this huge handout to Big Pharma.
Yeah.
After it was passed, they worked to fix it.
Yeah. And that's the way.
That's the way governance is supposed to work.
And imperfect and awful. And yes, it's a handout to insurance companies. And yes, it should be single payer. And yes, there should be a government option. There should be a public option. All of that is true. Given where we are now, the idea that we have actual little fixes we could do to make things a little bit better seems to be a good thing. I'm not going to hold a parade for it, but that's a good thing. And yet, the exact thing that, this is, I think, the point of the entire newsletter, was the exact thing that Democrats have been crowing about, Republicans have been refusing to do, actually, in a little tiny corner of your government, is actually getting done, and no one's talking about it.
Yeah.
Because it's transgressive of the existing narrative, which is Barack Obama's a monster who must be overthrown.
Exactly. We have gotten a number of great letters this week, and we're going to be reading them over the course of the next couple of weeks. One I wanted to read was from Carol in California.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Driftglass and Blue Gal, we are so grateful to have found you. You are truly needed in these times. I am especially happy that you found each other. Aw. Wish you and your family many years of success and happiness. Metaphorically, I believe we are all on a Christie-controlled bridge.
Ah.
We are stuck legislatively, and progress is stalled. Can't you hear Paul Ryan and company asking, is it bad that I don't feel for the children who are going hungry because of food stamp cuts? To which his right-wing companions reply, no, you don't have to care. Their parents vote Democrat.
Oh, yep.
That's very good. Happy to enclose the donations. Your broadcasts are an American treasure. Sincerely, Carol. Carol, your letter came at a time when I really needed it, and I want to thank you for that. I had to go to the DHS office this week, and we're still working on getting health insurance still. Yeah, we are.
How many months have you been working on that?
Since December 23rd was when my application went in, and they've lost my paperwork twice, and the second time they never found it again, so I had to go in with documentation.
Mind you,
he's supposed to call me today.
I want to underscore something here. Mm-hmm. We are good liberals and good Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife has been working, I would say, since October.
Yeah. Well, I tried to get on in October like a lot of people and didn't get on. So.
But pretty diligently for months now.
Well, because we lost Medicaid September 31st.
Yeah.
So,
And that was because in Illinois, there's a strategy to kick everybody off Medicaid and put them back on the expanded Medicaid.
Right.
So you count them all as new insurance, which I can understand. That's a numbers game, and it's legitimate to do that. But they're slammed.
Yeah.
There's no money to hire new case managers, as far as I can tell, or very little.
Well, the case manager I met with had a box of active files on the floor of his office that was as tall as our youngest child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have worked with people like that.
Who are good people. I don't blame him for personally for anything that has happened to me.
No, but it's a system designed to handle a garden hose, and somebody stuck a fire hose in the end of it and turns it on full blast.
And said, hold this. Yep.
And my wife, who I will now admit is smarter than me in so many ways, in case you didn't know that, is absolutely terrific about record keeping, document records, copies of things, signatures when you have kids with, you know, who need medication and on and on and on and have lots of different schedules.
Mm-hmm.
She's really good at that. She's also a terrific sound editor. So into the DHS office she went months ago with a meticulously prepared file with everything you could possibly
need. He requested. That everything. I got a letter saying we need these documentation. It was like the IRS persecution scale. No, actually it wasn't.
No.
It was a letter saying I need pay stubs, I need last year's tax return,
and
I need social security numbers for your family, and I mean it was stuff they needed so that I would qualify. Right. I understood that.
And
here's a letter of what we need.
Bound it, put it, wrapped a ribbon around it.
Took three hours to put it together, put it in a folder, wrote my name and phone number on the front.
Took it right to the drop-off point. Yep. And the point at which we lost control of it is the point at which
they lost it.
They just lost it. And so we have to go through it again. And they lost it again. And the deadline is the end of this month.
Yeah. Now, the deadline for Medicaid actually isn't – that's unspoken, but the deadline for Medicaid is not the end of this month. You can sign up for Medicaid anytime you want.
If
you qualify. Yeah.
Well, and this is the thing that cracked us both up was the fact that it is taken for someone who is clearly qualified for
it,
who is absolutely – who already has kids on Medicaid.
Yep.
There's no doubt about it. There's no gray areas. This is very cut and dried. They just can't get their shit together enough to do what is essentially check off three boxes and approve you.
Well, that's what makes me so sad about this and is so depressing about the DHS office from my perspective is I said this to the case manager. He said, "What's your level of education? Because I don't need that for your application, but we keep statistics on this."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "I have two master's degrees." And he went, "Jeez."
Yeah.
And that's why Carol's letter was so helpful to me, because I was sitting there feeling in front of him like, wow, I know I'm really overeducated to need public assistance with health insurance, but I'm making a difference, it turns out.
Yeah.
To some people. It made me feel very good to get the letters that we got this week. That's right. I'm this person. I am actually performing a job that people appreciate and need.
And we try to, help. We try to imagine what it would be like to navigate this.
Well, that's what makes me so sad and depressed
is
seeing everyone else in the waiting room with no papers, with no folder, with no anything, barely a wallet.
Yeah.
And they might not have photo ID. He needed photo ID. I had to prove who I was, which makes sense. I have to prove who I am to him so he can put me in the system. Duh. Of course he does.
And having been on other sides of these sorts of desks.
Desks, yeah.
I know how to make this thing run so much smoother. And it involves hiring more people and funding
lots
it properly.
Lots of more people and tracking them. Exactly. One of the reasons they lost our paperwork the second time is they had a temp worker in there going through paperwork. And this temp worker saw a stack of folders that were missing a piece of paperwork. And this temp worker apparently denied all 30 of them because, oh, no, they're missing this paperwork. They're denied. And that got them off of this temp worker's desk.
Right. So he can move on to the next 30 and the next 30.
And the next 30. And the caseworker who's, an employee there said, I don't know what I'm going to do because I can't find your folder. And that means there are 30 other ones that the person will get the denial letter and just say, oh, I'm denied Medicaid. So I'm not going to be insured.
Yeah.
Because they don't know how to cope with.
Well, it looks very official when the letter
arrives. It's very official to say you're denied.
Yeah.
And I got that letter and I was on the phone in 5 seconds saying this is not accurate.
The punchline to much of this is when we did our taxes. you push the button at the end. Oh, by the way, you're qualified for Medicaid. You know that, right?
Right. No. That was it. Not PayPal.
TurboTax.
TurboTax told us, by the way, you're eligible for Medicaid. We hope you've signed up.
Yeah. It was that simple. It's like they just do that. Oh, yeah.
Income and number of kids in your household means we know you're eligible for Medicaid. Sure hope you've signed up.
That's baked into the software.
Yes.
For tax preparation purposes.
Tax prep.
But it's beyond the capacity of the actual people who are doing the actual paperwork processing to just make that determination. Because
I really wish that they would robo-sign Medicaid applications like they robo-signed getting people out of their homes when they couldn't pay their mortgage.
Yeah. Well,
apparently that's okay. Nobody's gone to jail for that.
No.
But God forbid you should actually automatically approve someone for health insurance.
And this is the flip side of this is the same group. Population, by and large, that your conservative friends are insisting are just on Easy Street. All you got to do is go in. They give you lobster. They give you a steak. They just throw money at you. You can live on Easy Street because they've never had to do it. They've never had to set foot in that office. They've never. And you know what? If you sift through 3, 4, 10, 15 million people, you can find a couple who are abusive, who are wrong, who go slip through the cracks, who that temp worker approved when he shouldn't have as opposed to disapproved when he shouldn't have. You can find those people. But to mount an entire assault on the entire idea of social service safety net based on a couple of anecdotal stories that your cousin heard is such a grotesquely dishonest way to conduct public policy. But that's how we do it now.
Yeah.
There's a whole body of voters who think that the DHS office is full of hammocks for people who just want to hang out and do nothing because they've never had to go through it themselves, ever. And this is, believe it or not, after all of that I, me, my stuff, this is not a story about us.
No.
This is a story about how you break government.
Yeah.
You shrink it and starve it and underemploy it and underfund it and overload it.
And say, look, it doesn't work.
And say, look, it doesn't work. It's broken. Obviously, the system sucks. The people are lazy. And the only people left on Earth that it's safe to kick if you're a Republican, you can't own slaves anymore. Sorry, guys. And you don't have Jim Crow anymore. And you can't talk about women because, you know, you'll be sued. And
because they're busy.
The gays, the gays are coming to your neighborhood.
They're bullying you.
The only group it's really safe to sort of tell those old jokes about those people in public, you can still tell jokes about the coloreds in private, you know, at your club. But the only people it's safe to insult in public are government workers.
Yeah.
Government union thug employee, blah, 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 blah. You can do that almost completely uncoded. So guess who gets the shit kicked out of them? Because these people have been told.
Well, and recipients of government subsidies are.
These people have been told
Not business recipients of government subsidies.
No. Those are child
individuals who get who are not on Social Security and Medicare, but get help because they need it. Yeah.
Postal union workers are safe to kick around because those people, you know how those people are.
We're going to keep fighting for those people, Driftglass.
We sure are.
I know I've asked you this question before, and I'm going to ask you again. Are zombie apocalypse stories science fiction by definition?
Yeah.
Okay.
They sort of are. I mean, there's no science behind them. I mean,
except for the disease, which
the decomposition of the human body means that you wouldn't be able to see anything. Your eyes would stop functioning almost immediately. Your tendons would dry up. You know, there's no circulation, so your body would rot off your bones very quickly. So the idea that
there's this virus that stops all that from happening.
And that you still have shambling corpses wandering the earth. It's much more of a nightmare scenario. I mean, literally, the dream where you're running really fast, but you can't get away, and no matter how hard you try, they're coming for you. Everybody's at that dream. That's the zombie apocalypse in a dream. And it's what's the scariest manifestation of that would be the dead coming back to life. And suddenly the people you trusted, the people you love, the people you cared about are trying to kill you. And you can't reason with them and you can't talk to them. You just can put a bullet in their head. And that's transposing a really nightmarish Edgar Allan Poe kind of plot.
Yeah.
You know, where it feels like an all-encompassing dream.
Yeah.
And you transpose that into a real world with real people and real trucks and real cars and real problems. And so it feels science fiction. You know, I'd say it's science fiction, but there's no actual science underneath it other than the classic apocalypse, what happens after the world blows up and people try to survive, which is definitely a science fiction trope.
Well, and I just finished reading a book that I'd like to recommend to our listeners if they want to read some zombie science fiction. It's not a new book, but it's recent.
Is it called The Loudest Voice in the Room, The Story of Roger Ailes?
That's what you're reading.
Yeah, that's also the zombie.
Roger Ailes. It's a zombie apocalypse story.
It is. You can see the virus
I just finished reading Zone One by Colson Whitehead. He's an African-American writer who writes a lot about New York City, and this takes place in New York City. And I'm not going to give away any spoilers. The plot that's on the back of the book is about New York City's the world's been overtaken by zombies. They are working in Zone One, which is Manhattan, to clean it out of zombies so it can be resettled by human beings, building a wall around it. And the military has been in and gotten rid of nearly all of the zombies, but they now have civilian forces going in building by building. and cleaning out the stragglers. And the lead character in this is an African-American whose nickname is Mark Spitz because he doesn't swim.
Uh-huh.
And it's about not only his relationships with his cohorts, who are, as I say, part of the civilian forces that are just cleaning out one building at a time in New York City, but his relationship to the city, his relationship to technology, it takes place over 3 days, but it's a 200-page book because it talks all about how he survived to get where he is and so on. And it's a great story. I really enjoyed it. It's one of the first books I've read in years where I actually had to have a dictionary next to me because his Colson Whitehead's command of words is astonishing. So I do recommend it.
Let me add one more.
Yeah.
I'm not saying any writing is easy. I have never written a novel. I probably never will write one. The thought of it is cost prohibitive. There's lots of stuff I think I could do, but I just can't imagine I would ever recoup the cost and time and effort that I put into it.
That's why I want you to write a children's book.
Yeah, that's even harder.
It is.
But there is, as you mentioned, Zone One, there's good writing and there's lazy writing.
Yeah.
And I'm not putting down any one in particular, but I am saying that it's a lot easier to write about we're all fucked, the future's doomed.
Yeah.
Like in politics, it is much easier to just sort of fold your hands and say, well, we're all screwed.
Yeah.
And here's how it's going to play out. And it's going to be bad. It's going to be very, very bad. It's much easier to do that than to investigate the corners of that world and try to find some humanity and some hope and some something to hang on to.
Mm-hmm.
That's harder to do.
Even when things really are bad.
Yeah.
You know, and I almost abandoned Zone One in the middle of it because I'm like, this is whatever happens in this book. It's not going to end well because there are zombies. And then I thought, no, I should go. And it is. It's humanity affirming. It's courage in the face of that's what it's about. It's about courage in the face of things suck. But we're human. We're going to fight this and we're going to make it better.
And it's hard to do that in a way that is convincing.
Yes.
That doesn't feel like the little boy fell out of bed and it was all a dream.
No. Yeah. Yeah.
So
that doesn't happen in this book. And I'm not going to go any further than that, but to say, what is it that Melissa Harris Perry's dad wrote?
The struggle continues.
Yeah.
It does. And that's part of the price of the ride. That's part of the price of the ticket.
Yeah.
So, and people, especially
that's a good button to put on that. The struggle continues.
Yeah. There we go.
And every week, we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitties are Gidget and Gizmo. They are both foundlings. Gizmo started life being fed with an eyedropper. Oh, my goodness. And their human, J.E. in Indiana, says about cats that the best of them come to me.
Aww.
Isn't that nice? Yes. But they were both found in the carport, abandoned. So that's so sweet. And they love each other. Isn't that nice?
Aww.
You can send your internet kitty or kitties to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Unions, letter on the air unless you say otherwise.
So, Blue Gal, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
The internet kitties are really busy binge-watching Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2014, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Jeff Glass.
Okay.
What's wrong?
In honor of Hal Douglas passing, I decided to do the entire podcast.
No, you can't.
As Hal Douglas.
Hal Douglas. In a world.
In a world.
Yeah, you didn't know you knew Hal Douglas, but boy, do you know Hal Douglas?
Boy, God, yeah.
He's been every single one. In a world. That's him. All right.
And I can get close to that.
You need to get that job. You have a voice for radio. You really do.
In a world.
In a world.
Or I'll just do my impression of Rick yelling for Carl.
Carl.
Get Daryl. Merle's close by. Get Daryl to protect us. Carl.
I don't think you can go too far in Walking Dead. That's just my personal opinion. That doesn't mean I want to watch it all the time, but anybody who thinks, oh no, they went too far this time, doesn't get the show.
No.
So
it is in that same genre as Game of Thrones in the sense that they tell you up front, don't get too attached to anybody.
Yeah. Because
this is not about your heroes. This is about this horrible thing that's happening, and the people that actually survive are not necessarily the people who make it onto the movie poster.
But anything happens to Daryl and we riot.
Yeah. Well, that's the trick of the show. The more you winnow them down, the more attached you get to the ones who made
really
it.
Really made it, yeah.
And or you realize that the winnowing process is producing... there was this wonderful moment in, what was it, Failsafe, where, Walter Matthau was speculating on who would survive. And he said file clerks and prisoners would survive a clear war.
Yep.
File clerks behind a bunch of paper and prisoners in a concrete box.
Yeah.
And what society would you have with a bunch of sort of meticulous...
I was going to say cockroaches. Cockroaches would survive. Too. You know.
But the worst of the worst survive.
Yep.
People who have no compunction about killing anybody survive. And this is very much like The Stand also.
Yes.
You devolve it into two bands of people who are going to come to blows. And that's just the way that goes.
All right. For Science Fiction University today, we have three letters from listeners. And they are not trivia questions. I put these together because they're all kind of philosophical questions for you and I to discuss. And I think people will be interested.
Uh-huh.
First one is from Michael. And this is just sort of inside baseball, pure gossip.
Yeah.
What do you know about this?
Scroll right past this if you...
Michael asks, I've been enjoying your podcast on the Science Fiction University feature. So when I saw a tweet tonight about Harlan Ellison optioning Repent Harlequin, said the TikTok man.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
People have been waiting for that for a long time.
They have.
For a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I immediately thought of you. I'd love to hear your take on whether or not the story would make a movie and why Ellison would accept an option on it now. And you've talked to Harlan on the phone, Mr. Ellison on the phone, not about this, but about other things. And he's a great guy.
He is. Very nice. Very generous.
Do you think that Repent Harlequin, said the TikTok man, would make a good movie or is possible to film it? You, personally, I'm asking your personal opinion, Driftglass.
I think you would have to take the short story and you'd have to substantially grow it.
Okay.
Like the Minority Report.
Yeah.
It's, you take a short story with basically a very intriguing idea, very well written, an American classic. This is one of those two or three Ellison stories that appears in, the Norton Anthology of American Fiction.
Right.
This is a true classic of American literature. So the question I have is, can you make a movie out of a cask of Amontillado?
Yeah.
And you can. You can make a movie out of almost anything, but you have to really... In the case of Moby Dick, for example, you have to write this gigantic story down into a two-hour movie, which Ray Bradbury tried to do with some mixed success. And with the TikTok man, you'd have to write up to a two-hour movie. But the elements
are
there.
Develop the characters and their background and so forth. Yeah.
So what I would do if it were me is I'd get Mike Straczynski, who did Babylon 5, and then I'd call up Terry Gilliam and see if anybody had any leverage over him, knew where he buried a hooker, knew some crime he didn't want exposed, some horrible kink that he would
blush.
We're
going to expose to everyone that you're an American, Terry.
Yeah. No!
No, don't do it!
And ask him, this is if I got to do this.
Yeah, you would get to produce this movie.
Yeah, I get that.
You want Terry Gilliam as a director.
I would. I'd want the cameraman or with the scenarist. I'd probably beg and plead and try to get the people who worked on True Detective to get that sort of saturated, creepy
cinematographer. Yeah.
It is not sufficient to have a futuristic movie anymore that's all gleaming and shiny.
Yep.
You have to have it has to be a patina over a broken past.
Mm-hmm.
So old cars have to be there and poor people and realistic looking stuff. So very much like Looper.
Yes, yes.
Looper looked like modern times gone bad.
And then
bad.
The farm, And then you had the farm.
Yeah. But then you have to, you'd sit down with a writer. You'd get Harlan in a room and you'd ask him to break the story with you and go through it piece by piece, which he does. He can do. I mean, he's done television before. He knows how to write for a visual medium. So I think.
And you definitely want this movie to have on the credits written by Harlan Ellison, written by Cord Wainer Bird.
Yes.
So
I would absolutely want anything.
He's got to have creative control to a certain extent. Absolutely.
And I'd want him to. Now, mind you, he's the guy, I think, who congratulated Ronald Moore on taking what was essentially a horrible TV series and turning it into Battlestar Galactica updated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he, I remember hearing a bit of his speech saying, I was just, it was impossible that anybody could take what he used to call Battlestar Ponderosa.
Yes, which is what it was. Yep.
And turn it into an actual dramatic, interesting series that was mm-hmm. really compelling to watch. But Mr. Moore did that. So I would definitely, since the writer is still alive and still productive and still opinionated and thoughtful and has had 40 years to think about this story, you know, 40 years to work on it in his head and tinker with it and so forth, I would definitely want the primary author of it in the room telling us how he saw it breaking out into a larger story, because he's described a sliver of a future, and you'd have to expand that future to be interesting and encompassing and take 2 hours long. And of course, everyone knows how the story ends, so you'd have to really make it a drama.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's I wouldn't begin to know how to film it, but I know there are people who do know how to do that. So yeah, I'd be delighted to go see that.
All right. Number two, question number two comes from our friend Kevin Holtzinger.
Uh-huh.
And he has a bit of a science fiction university Bible bitch hybrid question.
Uh-huh.
I recently read how conservatives freaked out because a science fiction show, which was on the CW network, so we'd never watched it.
Right.
But it seemed to argue that in the future, the words under God would not appear in the Pledge of Allegiance, which, of course, under God did not appear in the Pledge of Allegiance until the 1950s. So
yeah. So deal with it.
Back to the original. My question is, do you think that in the future, religion will be treated more like in Star Trek, where it's something the human race will outgrow? Or will it be something more like Dune, where religion will still be around, but it won't look exactly like it does now? Wow. That's a big question.
Let me offer you the third choice, the Babylon 5 choice.
Okay.
Which is, there's this, as I recall, there's this scene where they're sort of getting to know each other. All the aliens are getting to know each other, and each species is asked to introduce its religion,
mm-hmm.
its faith, its whatever it is. And the humans don't know what to do, and until Captain Sheridan, I think. It was a nice scene. I didn't particularly like the first year of that series. It was too wooden, and it was had a real hard time getting its legs under it. But there was this one very lovely scene where the ambassadors are invited to learn about the human religion, and you just see a row of people. You know, this is so-and-so, and he's a Buddhist, and this is so-and-so, and this is a priest, and he's a shaman, and this is an Orthodox Jew, and this is an atheist. And it was, we don't have one religion. We will never have one religion. We will have a lot of religions, and we will have non-religions. And the idea, our gift, if we ever get around to fully exploiting it, is constructing a society where they can all live together, and they can all function together, and they can all sort of not go to war with each other, which Mark Twain despaired of that ever happening, and I do too. But it depends on how you view the future. If the future is apocalyptic and horrible, then it wouldn't surprise me at all if we ended up with a theocracy, because
mm-hmm.
that's how people cope with incomprehensible disaster.
Mm-hmm.
If we have a future where we have replicators and we have starships, or we just haven't fucked things up so horribly that it's irredeemable, then you're going to end up with, that kind of future affords the luxury of allowing lots of different religions. I would like it if, this is where I'm sure make somebody mad, but when don't I? It would be interesting to me. There was a lot of fiction in the late 90s, at least the stuff that I read, where Islam has become part of the standard portfolio of human religions that you find on extraterrestrial colonies.
Mm.
It's just one of those things,
yep.
along with every other religion. I would be delighted if the light side of Islam were to finally subdue the dark side of Islam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that we have sort of a whole bunch of very smart, compassionate, wise people representing a whole bunch of different faiths and non-faiths. And that's what my future would be.
I would like it if the light side of Christianity would dominate over the dark side of Christianity. Yeah. I mean, this is, there is the Central African Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Christian militias are engaging in ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
They call themselves Christian. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But I guess what I think about in terms of religion, and I'm speaking completely from the standpoint of being a citizen of the United States, and I want to make that clear because that colors everything you say. And people forget that. Religion has to, in the United States, be utilitarian. It has to meet the needs of the people that follow it. Uh-huh. And the needs are going to be based on what, you know, a lot of people call the only two emotions there are, fear and love. So if religion helps you live inside your fear, if that's where you're coming from, then fundamentalism and theocracy are the direction it's going to go. If religion helps you meet the need to love, then that religion is going to be utilitarian in terms of giving you a purpose to feed the poor, to take care of children, to do, you know, those that are less fortunate or less strong than you are, give you a purpose to help change the world and make it better. And it's going to be a battle between, it's been a battle since before Paul between those two sides of religiosity. And that, I don't think that will ever change. I really don't, regardless of what.
No, it can't. Yeah. It can't, because human nature being.
That is the human nature. Yep.
So the question is, always, how do you build a containment device called the culture that's sufficiently strong to restrain people's worst impulses, while at the same time not being so totalitarian as to demand that everyone follow the same flag?
Mm-hmm.
And that.
That's what we're all about.
That's all. That's the tricky part.
All right. Then we have an article here from a blog called Amor Mundi.
Uh-huh.
I guess with Love the World. Is that what?
Amor Mundi? Yeah, I guess so.
Mark in Washington State sent us this. And I'm just going to read this section of the post and hear your response to it. Because I don't really have an opinion about this because I'm not as knowledgeable as you are about science fiction. Science fiction's dirty little secret, this blogger writes, is that all too many of the most feted science fiction authors today preach transhumanism and glorious interstellar nirvanas at the helms of gleaming starships in order to shut the rubes up and keep them tractable. Science fiction today serves a brutally conservative agenda. You can't win against the elites because you're a scumbag prole, disguised as the trope, if you haven't been genetically modified or cybernetically augmented, you can't compete. Again and again, contemporary science fiction tells the reader that the elites are smarter and wiser and better than he or she is. This crap goes back to Heinlein. And then when you look at the actual behavior of real elites, you see a bunch of ignorant, incompetent fools fumbling and bumbling and stumbling and bungling around, as in the latest round of austerity madness in the global economy. The so-called best and brightest among the world's leaders can't seem to find their asses in a hall of mirrors. An objective observer might even be tempted to conclude that the elites are just like everyone else, no smarter, no more competent, no more knowledgeable, and no more skilled. Does science fiction today, in your opinion, serve a brutally conservative agenda?
Nah.
Me neither.
Nah. It doesn't really serve any. I mean, there are absolutely military science fiction that fetishizes, you know, uniforms and body armor and blowing shit up. There's a strong conservative libertarian streak that absolutely was present in Heinlein, although a bunch of other stuff was present too. I don't know who these transhuman authors are who preach interstellar nirvanas. I don't remember any of those. Maybe in the 50s, but I haven't seen a starship in a long time. I haven't seen anybody talking about Nirvana in a long time.
Yeah, no, it's quite the opposite, actually.
I can definitely see the brutality of, and this has the feel of someone who read into something, because I missed were any citations of any kind in this quote.
Well, and I can go look back at that blog post. I cut this out of the blog post, so I may be to blame for whether he saw any.
Probably. There is a dystopian view about winning against elites that goes back to probably Neuromancer, William Gibson. That is, there are. And Bug Jack Baron was another one. Norman Spinrad had a novel called Bug Jack Baron, which is really good, about a guy who figured out how to make people immortal.
Mm-hmm.
And it involved killing children at a particular moment in their development and transplanting an organ. And the cost of that was prohibitively high. Therefore, it was secret. And rich people were buying immortality. And the person who had controlled the process bought access to the richest people in the world and controlled them. And because they all had this terrible secret they couldn't reveal about why they were never going to die. But yeah, there's a libertarian streak, but most of the libertarian stuff in science fiction is either ridiculous or, I mean, Robert Heinlein's most libertarian characters were always trying to get the hell off Earth.
They wanted
the hell away from everybody. They didn't want to be around society at all. I mean, his prescription was the minute you have to show an ID for any reason, that's the time you have to leave. Because if you can't identify your neighbors and friends by face and a handshake, if a handshake isn't good enough, then society's gotten way too civilized and way too suffocating. And then you introduce this trapdoor called starships or faster than light travel that lets people leave.
Mm-hmm.
So, yay, we have a new frontier. We can all just go away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was more of what was going on, I think, in those novels then. But there was a real clear libertarian focus in a lot of science fiction that involved the good, smart, bright people surviving and overthrowing the bad, incompetent people.
Well, I was going to say, that's sort of the trope that I see even today with the teen fiction that our daughters are starting to get into. You know, Hunger Games, Ender's Game, Divergent, those are all about the common kid, the teenage kid, overcoming a horrible society that may or may not have technology at the helm.
And
you know,
it's E.T. I mean,
yeah, it's the same.
The bad guys in E.T. were the government guys with the keys on their belts.
Yep.
And the hazmat suit. And that's because, never forget, the golden age of science fiction is 13.
It's 13.
It's designed for 13-year-old boys and now girls to feel like they see the world around them sucks and has problems, and only they can save it.
Well, I was going to say, the very first time I saw The Matrix, and I thought, here is this young guy coding all night long and partying all day, and he has got a shit job, and he's the one who's going to save the universe. Gee,
he's secretly
who their audience is.
Yeah, he's secretly the most important person
in
the world.
He's going to get the hottest chick, and he's who's badass, and save the universe, because he's the one.
Yeah. No
spoilers, but yeah. And they knew their audience, didn't they?
And the idea of, you know, the man against the hidden unseen forces who's suddenly thrust into a situation where he can't trust anyone.
Yeah.
That's notorious.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's North by Northwest. That's Hitchcock.
Yes.
That's
absolutely, you know, Hitchcock. Yeah.
You absolutely have to have this
common man fighting.
The common man versus the vast, sinister, and unseen forces who, when you get up close to them, are evil, but often very incompetent. Not very good at what they do. They're just sort of, you know, they just have brute force. And he will outwit them by virtue of his cleverness and the fact that Cary Grant can't be beat.
No, he can't be beat. Hey,
all right.
Everybody have a great week. We love you.
Love you, babe.
I love you, too.
Happy spring.
Happy spring. Bye.
Bye.